Fourscore and hundreds of years ago, the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast was born. The Medicare podcast with growing pains. And now crapped out once again, Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Why, thank you. Thank you, everybody. I'm blushing, I'm humbled, and I'm appreciative. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for that magnificent applause. This is the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast, the one podcast for lazy people of all stripes and sexes. And on a second, this is episode number 46. We're recording this on April 23rd. Spring has sprung here in Arizona. It's going to be 100 degrees here for the first time in 2020 in a couple of days, if not today. Probably not here today because we're up in the foothills. And so it always takes a little while longer for the 100 degree weather to strike us here in Arizona because we're 1,500 feet or so higher than the rest of the Valley of the Sun. So listeners, thank you for joining us. Drew McMillan, thank you for being our announcer. I love your dulcet tones introducing every episode of the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. Now, what is the lazy man that we're podcasting to? That lazy man or lazy lady is someone who knows they need to learn about Medicare, but isn't really excited about the job. So we try to throw some Medicare information out there periodically that will help them make their Medicare decisions and help them understand that Medicare doesn't have to be scary and intense. Once they make and execute a few decisions, they're done. They don't have to sit and think about it all the time if they've done what I say. So that's the lazy man or the lazy lady that we are podcasting to at the Medicare for the Lazy Man. Here's a lazy guy, Randy Carson, Mr. Engineer. How are you today?
I'm good, Doug. You made a comment there that brought something to mind. You said that Cave Creek was a lot higher than the surrounding territory.
Hmm?
The altitude's bigger, too.
Yeah. Well, okay. All right. You know, put your beer in your joint.
And, yeah, there
and
you
think
go.
Think about that for a minute. I didn't mean the people. I meant, well, the people actually are higher if they're up, on the ground. But it takes longer for the warmth of spring to reach Cave Creek because the altitude is higher. And as you know, since we're higher, if there are torrential rains, which might happen once every, 50 or 100 years, Phoenix has built a dam halfway down to Phoenix so that our rainwater will not wash away their homes. The Cave Buttes Dam.
Yeah, I remember all stuff runs downhill from Cave Creek.
Yeah, it really does. It's best to be in Cave Creek than downhill from Cave Creek.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, I probably won't talk about it right now, but you and I did leave what we affectionately call as a cliffhanger or a hanging chad last podcast about the history and the usage of nitrous oxide. Now, I don't specifically remember how we got there, but
I asked about dentistry. I think we were talking about dentistry, and you have a unique expertise or a connection to the dental arts by virtue of your relatives. So
yes.
I think you ought to share that knowledge with us now. And if we don't even hit on Medicare today, who cares?
Well, I did look up quite a bit of history of nitrous oxide, which is obviously used frequently in dentistry. And some people call it laughing gas. Some people call it a lot of different things. But the history of nitrous oxide is a long history. It was discovered by an English chemist in 1772. And it was originally called phlogisticated nitrous air. I don't know what
took them so long to What took them so long to trot that stuff out? Because back in the 1800s, we were still pouring whiskey down the gut of people who were going to have their teeth yanked out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, the fun part of nitrous oxide apparently hit in about the 1820s. Now, again, we're talking England here.
Yeah,
they were having nitrous oxide parties.
Oh,
in late early 1800s England, and then eventually we come to my original remembrance of nitrous oxide history. It was in 1844. Dr. Horace Wells, a dentist. Again, you know, my entire family is dentists, so we have, you know, we gather around, you know, Thanksgiving, and we talk root canals, but. It's a wonderful day. The dentist
Hey, listen, we were talking about insurance around the dining room table, so you know, maybe dentistry would have been more exciting. I don't know.
So Dr. Wells was a dentist in mid-1800s, Hartford, Connecticut, and he attended a nitrous oxide demonstration put on by Gardner Quincy Colton. And during the show, a man who had taken the nitrous oxide injured his legs after stumbling, trying to get up on stage. And he said he felt no pain. So that piqued some interest with Dr. Wells, and he started trying to use it in his dental practice. But long story short is it took a long time to catch on. And Dr. Wells himself started doing stage shows and offering to extract teeth for anybody in the audience that had a bad tooth. And there was a lot of them. So he would bring them up on stage, feed them full of nitrous oxide, pull their tooth out, and he kept it in a bucket, all the extracted teeth. Now, if you go back into the his dental practice back east, there's actually a museum of his original dental practice, I believe in Hartford, and the original bucket with thousands and thousands of extracted teeth is in the museum. So that is where my memory stops with this.
All right. So first of all, very prodigious memory you have, sir. I commend you and salute you for being able to dredge up all those facts. But now I have many, many, many questions. First of all, you got a bucket with thousands of teeth. Would I be correct in assuming that those teeth came from more than one individual?
Yes.
Okay, so he couldn't hire somebody to just be a plant in the audience and raise his hand whenever he asked for somebody with a bad tooth.
Well, the average adult only has 32 teeth, so the plant could only work for 32 tries.
Okay, there you go. Now, my next question is, how many people go to a show, a stage show, and just sitting there enjoying the show, and if some moron up on the stage happens to ask if anybody wants to have a tooth extracted, oh yeah, take me, I'll do it. extract my teeth.
Go ahead, pull that puppy out of there. You know, that's a great question. I don't know how you advertise. You know, we were talking the other day about how to advertise, you know, Medicare for the Lazy Man in certain target audiences. I have no idea how we would go after people wanting their teeth pulled if we were in the nitrous oxide business.
Well, if I had to speculate, I would say this came around the time that dentistry was gaining more respect because it prior to the art of dentistry as practiced by doctors, it was done by barbers. If I recall correctly, you would go get your hair cut and your beard trimmed and your teeth pulled, or, you know, problematic teeth that looked at. Didn't they do oral surgery?
I'll give you, this is probably going to be way more than you ever wanted to know. But if you look back in the history of dentistry, it's been a pretty brutal practice in the early days. And when they couldn't get a barber to pull their teeth out, and he couldn't get one loose, which happens occasionally, they had a thing called a turnbuckle. So picture in your mind a pipe wrench, how the harder you pull, the tighter it grips.
Uh-huh.
A turnbuckle was the same thing for a tooth. They'd stick that puppy on there and they'd start twisting until it finally popped out. And that was before nitrous oxide. So, you know, nobody wanted to go to the dentist.
No. And frankly, I still am not a huge fan. I occasionally get to bite my dentist once in a while when he said something offensive to me, a little bit of payback. And I think I've told you my sodium pentothal story. I was 17 years old and had my, no, I was 19 years old. And he stuck a needle in my arm, said, "This is sodium pentothal." And I'm not sure if he told me to count backwards, but it sure did be completely I woke up what seemed like 2 seconds later with each arm beautiful, beautiful, and a magnificent one. And they were taking me to the recovery room. I had no pain, my God, sodium, because I didn't know that anything had happened. And I didn't realize, I had never had Novocaine before. I'd never had a cavity. So my mouth was completely numb, full of bloody cotton. And I had no clue. So I spit blood all over the shoulder of her. She looked at me like I was lower than the whale poop on the bottom of the Marianas Trench. And I turned to the other side and I was going to explain how that was completely accidental. And of course, all that came out was a bunch of gibberish and more blood on her beautiful white dress. And man, they dragged me in that recovery room, just flung me on the couch. So decades later, I was talking to an oral surgeon who was describing how sodium pentothal was and why was it that we don't still use it today? I said, immediately to sleep, I immediately woke up and I had no ill effects from the anesthesia. And I said, it was just fantastic. Seems like it would have a lot of you. And he said, well, let me describe the situation to you. You were given an injection of sodium pentothal, and then you went on for some period of time while they pulled your teeth out. You were unconscious, right? And he said, you were hovering near death. I said, really? Yes, that's why we don't do it anymore, because it's insane to use that stuff. So I dodged a huge bullet when I had my wisdom teeth. Well, anyway.
I've got to tell you one related story about a personal experience I had with nitrous oxide. The first time I ever had it, the difference between sodium pentothal and nitrous is that you are aware of what's going on when you're on nitrous, and you just don't care. I mean, literally, after I got a good snort of that nitrous oxide, the dentist could have said, okay, are you feeling good now? Yeah, feeling good now. Okay, we are going to saw your feet off. And you would have said, go for it. It's the craziest stuff I've ever had.
How long does the effect last?
Not very long. As soon as they shut the valves off, you're back. But
okay.
I've never really had it. So crazy stuff.
Well, I had about a 30 or 40 year relationship with my dentist who just retired. He was a young guy when he bought a practice near where I lived. And so I basically, every time I went in there and he was going to do a drill and fill or something, I would say, I want nitrous. And he said, well, we'll do that. Let's do it next time. And for 30 or 40 years, it was always next time. I always forgot to ask and he always forgot to give it to me. I'm not even sure he had it, but he was always promising, holding out promise of having nitrous, and I've never had the stuff, and it seems like it'd be a boon to dentistry. I mean, if you sit there and don't care, that's half the battle. If you're afraid of the pain that's maybe going to come, maybe not, then it's going to be more likely to happen.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And as I said, the craziest part about it is you're totally aware. You just don't, you feel everything. You feel the pain. You're totally conscious, but you just don't care. It's the strangest freaking thing I've ever felt.
I'm reading a series of books about the Napoleonic Wars and the British Navy and their operations during wars. And it seems to me they could have used something to remove pain, because basically after a battle, those people, the surgeons were busy with their saws, sawing off limbs. That was their solution. I think even in the War of Northern Aggression in the 1860s, that was the common response of a surgeon to a battle casualty, hack it off. And I'm sure that nitrous oxide would have been a welcome addition to the tool bag of the surgeon.
Yeah, until they shut it off.
Yeah. No, turn it on. Leave it on.
My boy. Back when you're crawling out of the tent past the pile of legs.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Get rid of those legs, orderly. Well, you know,
I suppose we ought to talk about some Medicare today.
I'm equivocal because, frankly, in this day of the China virus, we're not meeting together. People are socially distancing themselves, and so I was asked by a member of your crack staff a few months ago a series of questions. One of which was, "What happens? Why is attending a Medicare seminar or a meeting or some kind of Medicare educational event not good?" Or what, you know, because she heard me say that it was not worthwhile, and I told people I advise them not to do it. It's a waste of time in most cases, I think, for most people. And then I thought, well, since nobody's going anywhere, I could just table this question and address it when the economy has been reawakened, if that ever happens. And then I thought, well, maybe we should reinforce to people that at least for Medicare enrollment and Medicare educational, they're not really missing any opportunities to gather knowledge about Medicare in order to help them make their decisions. So I thought, why not talk about what would happen if they were invited to Medicare seminars or meetings now, you know, if the lockdown wasn't happening? Why or why would they not be into these meetings? Obviously, people want to get knowledge that they don't otherwise have. And this is why I wrote my book, Medicare for the Lazy Man. And this is for people that are too lazy to get out of their pajamas and their sweat, go out to meetings, the book. But in any event, it also points up the stupidity of the federal bureaucracy. Once you set up a department in the federal government, a living, breathing entity that will never, never, ever die will be thrown at it every year because they will be able to say, well, look, if an agent wants to hold an event, an educational event or a sales event, they can do so, but they can't just tack a flyer to a telephone pole and invite people to come on over. There are so many rules and regulations the federal government has set up that the insurance companies that have the products that the agent is selling will be severely penalized if the agent violates any of these rules. Now, how would the government find out about any rule violations? Well, they have an army of secret police. And anytime an agent submits a request to have a meeting, a Medicare educational event, the secret police could be in the audience taking notes and waiting to report back to the federal government as to whether the rules were complied. So basically, there are two types you want to have to gather people and to hopefully impress them with their knowledge and professionalism so that those will purchase insurance. The two types of meetings are educational events, and those two types of meetings look a lot alike. You're basically collecting a bunch of Medicare aid and putting them in chairs in little rows, maybe in a circle in a room, and perhaps offering them some or whatever and telling them about Medicare. But the differences between pretty much in Medicare marketing and sales events are different than educational events. There are a lot of rules that, frankly, that differentiate the two. And so I wanted to turn this into a little quiz, and I don't know if this will be successful or not, but Randy, I want to use you as my guinea pig, and I want to ask you, I'm going to give you an activity, and I want you to tell me whether this activity would be permissible at a Medicare educational event and,
okay. All right.
And or a Medicare sales event. So
permissible in either or both?
Either or. You could say both. You could say neither. You could say, well, I think educational, yes, but sales, no.
Okay, now, all right.
If that's too complicated, we can simplify it even more, which is what we try to do for all things Medicare around here. We try to bring them down to their lowest common denominator. But there are some, I've got a list of things here at these meetings.
Okay.
Okay, so here's an example. Host the event at a public venue as opposed to like somebody's house. Can you have your meeting in your living room and invite the general public to be in attendance in your house?
I would. Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying, or should it be at a public venue?
I would say that it should be at a public venue.
Well, you're correct. For both types of meetings, it's required that it not be, that it must be. How about advertising? If you're an agent and you want to have an event, are you able to advertise your event?
No.
Well, you're half right. For a marketing and sales event, you're not allowed to advertise it as an educational event. You can only advertise. It's confusing, and I may have misled you. I should have read the whole question. Are you allowed to advertise it as an educational event? You're not allowed to do that for a sales event, but you must do that for an educational event. Now, let's see. Should you expect secret shoppers? That's that army of secret police that will be sitting in the audience critiquing your behavior and reporting back to the federal government. Should you expect them in the audience?
Oh, they will be there in force, more than likely.
Yeah, you're right, in both types of meetings. They're going to come to either one. Now, how about conducting health screenings or genetic testing?
No.
You're right. You're very good at this. How about providing meals? Can you provide meals?
My answer to that is no, but you could probably provide refreshments.
Well, as it turns out, you can provide meals at an educational event, but not at a sales event. And I don't know why. I know that if I were to say, Randy, if you're an agent, you want to have a meeting, and you're not allowed to provide a meal, can you provide a snack? And your answer would be, and I would say, well, okay, how about a plate of turkey? Well, that would be considered a snack. Sure. Okay. I could do that. How about some mashed potatoes?
my mouth is watering now, Doug, as we speak.
Well, let's throw in a little gravy.
Oh, my gosh.
What you've done there is you've violated the federal government's guidelines against serving meals. You've served three different types of snacks, but you put them together and you've got a meal. And well, so that is
Let's put
remote.
Some pumpkin pie in there, too.
No. No.
Oh, darn it.
You've made it a meal, and you're not allowed to have a meal at an education or at a sales event. I don't know why that would be, but now how about gift cards, gift certificates, or cash giveaways?
Oh, hell no.
Yep, that's right. You cannot give away anything that's easily convertible to cash, and that includes gift cards. Can you provide giveaways like pens and tchotchke and contact?
You might be able to do, in a sales event, you could do tchotchke in an edge. I don't know. I would think you could do tchotchke on both.
You ought to be allowed to do both, and in fact, they do allow you to do that. I think the rules were a lot more strict a few years ago, and they've been loosened up a little bit. Can you request or accept a referral of somebody, if you say to the audience, hey, I would like to know if you've got any friends or relatives, can you ask that question?
No.
Right?
You could I think in that particular context, you might be in a similar situation to an attorney. You have to wait for them to contact you.
Well, that's exactly right here. This is not the kind of thing where you're encouraged to spread the word, and you got to tread a fine line. You can post an approved carrier sign-in sheet labeled optional, but you cannot request that people fill out the information on a sign-in sheet. If they don't want to do it, you can't force them to do it. If a participant in one of these meetings asks you, are you allowed to respond beyond the very specific factual information?
No.
Half right.
Half
right. In a marketing or sales event, you can spout off all you want to, but in an educational event, no, you cannot respond beyond the specific information.
So in a marketing sales event, you can do some puffery.
Yeah, you can. And frankly, how do you draw the line? How do you tell where the puffery has started and the response to the actual factual information has ended?
I believe it's Doug when the men in black stand up in the meeting. the ones in the black suits with the little black hats and the black sunglasses, and they start paying very close attention.
My first picture that I drew there was, I always draw a mental picture when you talk, and the first one was about the actor Jones and his Men in Black movie persona. Yes.
I think that started out as insurance investigators.
But then you switched me to the Blues Brothers. So I frankly, you're dragging me around the dance floor on that one. Well, now let me ask you one more thing here. Are you allowed to distribute or collect enrollment applications? Remember, the whole reason you're in business is to get applications from people who need insurance to provide Medicare coverage. They need insurance because Medicare is kind of crappy and doesn't really cover everything. So you've got a lot of exposure when you... So are you allowed to distribute or collect enrollment applications?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. I would say in the marketing sales meeting, yes, you could distribute the applications, but I don't think you could collect them.
Well, in this case, you're allowed to do both in the sales meeting, but not allowed to do either in the educational meeting, because they think the people coming to the educational meeting could be unfairly swayed to enroll. In other words, we talked about snake oil our last episode, and we talked about how a good snake oil salesman can get his audience all riled up, and they'd be waving their handfuls of money at him saying, I want to buy, you know. Well, I guess they're afraid that that would be a negative for the audience. They don't want to get them all worked up and purchase without having a chance to think. So if it's an educational event, you cannot distribute applications, get your audience so excited that they fill out those applications and buy your product. You're just not allowed to do that. I've got a stack of all kinds of stuff trying to describe the differences between the two meetings, but I got to tell you, the rules are enforced by the secret police. So I don't even bother with these meetings. And frankly, I don't think people should bother with them. If you're invited once the lockdown is over in your area, if you are getting postcards from insurance people who want to talk about Medicare and they lure you to a fancy restaurant with the promise of a meal or a snack or a door prize of some kind, and let's say that they stay within the guidelines, which seem to be very fluid and ever-changing, then you're going to walk out of there, depending on whether it's a sales event, maybe with a little more Medicare knowledge, but you're going to walk out with one person's opinion of what they think you ought to do, and that person is generally compensated to sell you Medicare Advantage plan. Understand, I think a Medicare Advantage plan is less beneficial to the average Medicare than a Medicare supplement. I recommend that if you go to these meetings, make sure that you don't buy without it. Medicare Advantage plans have a lot of holes and gaps in them. Medicare supplement plans provide thorough coverage, but they don't pay the great commissions, so that you don't hear about them. And that's why I don't recommend it, because Medicare Advantage is... So that's the short version, and I tried to make it a fun game, but you won. You were, hands down, you were an expert of the items that I have marked in yellow here.
Oh, there's there you go.
That's a lot of rules, but
it is.
Good job.
I think some of them, I mean, I understand the difference between education and a sales meeting, but I did have one thought, just because this is the way I think. I did have one thought cross my mind. You know, you were talking about not getting the people attending your educational event all stirred up to go buy something because they can't at an educational event.
They're not allowed to.
But you could have a sales event right next door.
Well, as luck would have it, that's one of the things that they changed. It used to be that you could have an educational event, and then you had to tell everybody, okay, go home. You had to chase them out of the room and make them go away, lock the doors, turn the lights off. And now you are allowed to hold a sales event in the same spot after the educational event has ended. So you have to tell them to go home, leave the room, but they can come back in a couple of minutes, and then you can start your non-educational event, your sales and marketing.
And we have meals.
Oh, yes. So that's exactly right. You could actually put the gravy on the turkey and the potatoes.
Oh, dear. You know, there's always a way around it. But ultimately, we have used up our podcasting resource time today.
And I hate it when that happens.
And we need to tell our folks thank you.
Well, thank you, folks. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to watch Drew McMillan on powerboattv.com. He joined the show in 2020, and his episodes are up on that website if you want to see Drew McMillan at work in his Canadian environment. That's where you can. And buy my book, Medicare for the Lazy Man. We have an exciting announcement. It is now in the middle of April, but sneaking up on the end of April, in January 27th, my birthday, we sent in the files for the audiobook version of Medicare for the Lazy Man 2020. And finally, yesterday, they didn't even bother to tell me. They just put it on sale. I don't know what took them 3 months to do that, but we now have the audio version, the ebook or Kindle version, and the paperback version, all available for you at Amazon.com or the paperback version at BarnesandNoble.com. So buy the book, read it, send us questions at DBJ, that's DBJ, at the MLM, no, DBJ at MLMmailbag.com. That's for email questions that you have about Medicare or questions about why Randy is rude to me all the time and or anything, you know, like what is the altitude in Cave Creek, Arizona? You know, pretty much we'll answer anything.
I know it's a lot higher than it is here.
Yeah, well, that's it used to be on weekends, but then, you know, just every day now.
Oh, my God. It's really, really, really smoky up around Cave Creek. What's going on? Yeah.
Well, I noticed that our local dispensary has closed up, and there's a for rent sale sign on the door. I don't know what the heck happened. I thought that was supposed to be like a gold mine for people.
You know, if you can't make money selling pot, you know, like on a street, you know, legally.
Yeah.
You got something wrong there.
Well, it seems like every lowlife in the world used to sell pot and do just fine at it, but they open a store and, you know, no bueno.
No bueno. No mas, no mas. No dinero.
Well, thank you for your fine recording engineering job today. I'm sure this episode sounds as fine as it could be, and I appreciate your effort.
Thanks, Doug, and thank you. Everybody out there in the listening audience, you have just spent about 33 and a half minutes having coffee, metaphorically speaking, with the anti-insurance insurance guy, Doug Jones, with Medicare for the Lazy Man.com.
Bye-bye.